Welcome, everyone. This is the seventh lecture for the Mises Academy class, Econ 730, Keynes, Krugman, and the Crisis. And this lecture is sort of a fun one, if you will. We're not going to get too technical in it. It's mostly just reading a bunch of stuff that Paul Krugman has written and said over the years. And the big point here is that, maybe go ahead and advance the slide, it's Krugman and the housing bubble. And so we'll see that the big picture here is that Krugman's Keynesian analysis led him to quite clearly call for the creation of a housing bubble after the dot-com crash. And so that should give one pause when now he's calling for the same sorts of policies this time around. The point being, when you focus narrowly on just fostering spending and you're just trying to think, oh my gosh, the only way to get us out of this rut is to, what can we do to get people and businesses to go spend, spend, spend? Well, you end up generating asset bubbles. And so we're going to, the assigned reading for this week's lecture focuses on the stuff that Krugman wrote in his columns and then also like in interviews he gave, and that's the function of giving you some of those blog posts from Mark Thornton and the articles from Danny Sanchez to, so you can have all that stuff documented. But the point being that, you know, this, it's easy in retrospect for us to know that that was a housing bubble, but the point is at the time, Krugman was quite explicitly calling for it. And now, I mean, I don't have it documented for you because I don't want to overload you with material, but he's saying things this time around in our current mess along the lines of, well, you know, let's not spend all this time pointing fingers over who did what back in the day. That the issue is right now the economy is stuck, and so we need to get out of this. And, you know, we can, as an academic history of thought exercise or, you know, historical work, we can go look at the causes and consequences of the housing bubble, but right now we've clearly got inadequate demand. Right? So the point is that it's, you know, Krugman, and where that comes up is when Krugman argues with Chicago school guys who think that interest rates are too low. And it's, it, like I say, maybe I'll try to dig some of that up and put it in the forum if you guys are interested. But the point is Krugman this time around has said things very close to saying, I don't care what caused the bubble last time. That's irrelevant. What matters is right now we are in a slumped economy, and so we need to get out of this, and we need more spending. And so it's the point is, if he's wrong, if it's his policies that caused the bubble last time and that would just happen again, well, then maybe you need to figure that out before you go recklessly calling for another bubble. So that's partly why we're taking the time to do this. Now, having said all that, I think it's kind of silly for me to just walk you through a bunch of blog posts that are written in plain English. Right? So there's really not too much technical stuff in this week's material. You can digest that for yourselves mostly, and just, you know, leave it up to you guys to determine whether you think Krugman really did call for the housing bubble or if his, you know, his defense techniques now are accurate or valid. So what, let me take some of the time then, since we do have that leeway. What I'll do in the beginning here is give you the Austrian take on the stuff we've covered so far. So just because I realized a few people were mentioning to me that I see some people in the comments saying that your video and audio is great, and then when I hit record, it gets a little bit screwy. That happened to me too when I was watching. It's the one time I've watched another professor's lecture, so I'll mention that to the, you know, if you can, if any of the TAs are on, you know, note that I'm just confirming that, yeah, that was my experience too when I was watching Peter Klein's lecture. It was crystal clear, like he was in the room with me, and then when whoever hit audio hit the record thing, then I could still watch it, but it wasn't as crisp. So I don't know if you guys can diagnose what's causing that, but I'm agreeing with Chris Franco that that happened to me too. Okay, but back to the lecture here. So let me give you some of the points that the Austrians would give in response to the sort of Keynesian material argument that we've gone through so far. Okay, because I realize I was trying so hard to make sure you guys got all the subtleties and the nuances of the Keynesian position, and then some of you were saying, hey, we don't, you know, what's the Austrian take on this? Are you fine with the ISLM diagram, or, you know, what do we say? So let me, since I think this lecture, we've got some extra time, I'll go ahead and take some time to do that. One last thing, I see some, at least one TA now is logged in and watching. So if you guys can check the TA email inbox, I sent the revised PowerPoint that had these first few slides that I just added in the last half hour. So if you could swap that in and post that so that people who download the hard copy are looking at the right thing. All right, so first of all, and a lot of this stuff is going to be generic Austrian economics, but you're right, I should say this at some point. The Keynesian analysis, it involves aggregation that of a degree that just obscures Austrian business cycle theory, right? So you don't have a structure of production, in certainly not in the ISLM type framework, certainly not in the what's called hydraulic Keynesianism, or what we would now call like the neo-Keynesians or the old Keynesians, that those big macro models that they would build, just tying together a few variables like consumption and investment spending and government spending and so on, and just reduce the economy to a single number, that's illegitimate. I see some people don't know what the term aggregation means. So aggregation means when you have a bunch of little things and you pile them all together to get one thing. So instead of, so the Austrians would worry about, you know, the Austrian structure of production, talk about, oh, there's different stages, right? There's the mining sector, then there's the wholesale, then the manufacturing and the wholesale, the retail, things like that. Distribution is in there somewhere perhaps. And so you're taking a bunch of things that are different and you're lumping them all together, and that's where the analysis starts. So, I mean, in a sense, even the Austrian approach aggregates things, right? You look at things in terms of what stage of production they're in. So, oh, it's the consumer stage. Oh, it's a second order good. It's a third order good, when not all third order goods are identical. But there's thousands and thousands of different types of third order goods. So, I mean, even the Austrians and their canonical analysis of the economy, like if you're going to do business cycle theory, whatever it is that you're doing, they, I guess you could say, use aggregation too, but the point is the Keynesians do a heck of a lot more, so that you're reduced to just saying, oh my gosh, is there enough spending right now in the economy to maintain full employment? When the Austrians are going to say, well, no, that's not really accurate enough. And it's funny, Scott Sumner, the guy that we talked a little bit about, I guess it was maybe last week, the quasi-monetarist, the guy that I think is insane, that he thinks Ben Bernanke's been too tight, on his blog recently, he really just epitomized this problem, in my view, because he said that he was at a dinner party talking with, or I don't know if it's a dinner party, but like at some social gathering with intelligent people just who weren't very well versed in economics, and he was explaining to them, he said, yeah, the Fed right now, you know, they're worried that if they think the level of spending is just right. They think that if they don't want to let total spending fall any lower, because then we'd fall back into deflation. And so, you know, they're on the lookout for that. But on the other hand, they don't want to stimulate more. They don't want to expand their balance sheet, because they're worried that if there's more spending, that will lead to overheating. And so looking at the trade-off between inflation and unemployment, the Fed right now thinks the total spending is just about right, and that's why they're not doing anything. You know, they're not selling off their assets, but they're not adding any more. They're just holding pat because they think total spending right now is just about right. And he said the people at the dinner party or whatever it was, their mouths fell open. All right, and so then I kind of made a wiseacre remark in the comments saying, well, Scott, you know, you can get them to close their mouths if you say, of course, there's schools of thought out there that think the economy is more sophisticated, and you can't just sum up the entire macro economy by just saying, is spending too high, too low, or just right? Whereas that's what Scott was doing. I mean, explicitly doing that. It wasn't just like that was some implication of his analysis that he wasn't aware of. I mean, he was literally saying there's three states the economy can be in. Spending's too high, too low, or just right, and the Fed can pick which of those three we're going to be in. End of story. And if the Fed foolishly picks just right when it's not just right, well, then we have a recession. So, I mean, that's what I mean with aggregation, where you're just picking a few key things to summarize the entire economy, and then you think that you can just manipulate those, and then everything, all the problems will be solved. So, I mean, just to give you an analogy, it would be like saying that, if we can control carbon dioxide emissions or something, or control how much heat factories gave off, and we said, this central board that's concerned with the total heat in the economy, we could make it a little bit hotter, we could make it a little bit cooler, or it thinks the temperature's just right. What are they going to do? And if they decide not to do anything, not to like turn up the air conditioner or not to pump heat into the atmosphere, well, they must think it's just right. And beyond the ability of us to influence the temperature, the idea that we would try to summarize the economy and try to explain whether we were in a recession or not, or if we had strong, sustainable growth based on what's the temperature outside, we could all say that would be crazy. And so it wouldn't be like, if the economy's not growing and unemployment's too high, maybe it's because it's not hot enough. So maybe we should do what we can to raise the temperature. You could just see that would be crazy. Even though it's true, if it were 10,000 degrees Celsius, the economy would be devastated because we'd all burn up. And if it were, 3 degrees Kelvin, the economy would be devastated because we would all freeze. But even though going to those two extremes, I can wreck the economy, that doesn't mean that there is some optimal temperature in between there that policymakers should try to point the economy towards. Okay? So you guys see what I'm saying? I hope that analogy helps, but my point is when I hear Scott Sumner saying the Fed is worried that if total spending goes up, we'll have too much inflation. If total spending goes down, we'll have deflation, and then unemployment will be too high. So it thinks total spending right now is just right. I mean, that's as inadequate and crazy to me as talking about the temperature, or almost. So that's one thing. And one way to think about this is you may notice next week when we read Krugman's response to my Sushi article where I'm talking about the capital structure and how you can have an unsustainable boom, and Krugman responds to that. And he sort of concedes the point theoretically and then says, yeah, but how do we know empirically that's really what's going on? And then he throws out some stuff, and it's clear that he doesn't really even get the Austrian story, because he says some things, so I'm just priming you here for what you're going to read next week, that Krugman throws out some challenges to Austrian business cycle theory that if they were if what he's saying were not true, that would be a problem for Austrian business cycle theory. So in particular, Krugman refers to macroeconomic research showing that central banks apparently can manipulate the business cycle. And Krugman throws that out, saying, what do you Austrians say about that? When, duh, that's our theory too, Krugman. We think that central banks influence the business cycle. All right, so that's partly what I'm getting at, is that mainstream economists, because they don't have a disaggregated sectoral model of the economy's capital structure, the way the Austrians do, they really don't even understand when you start talking to them about Austrian business cycle theory. That they think, in grad school, I tried to explain it once to some of my classmates, and I was explaining, interest rates are too low, that gives entrepreneurs the wrong signal, and so they start investing in unsustainable lines. And so the guy just said, so it's a theory of overinvestment. And I said, well, no, it's not really overinvestment, it's malinvestment, right? Because the way he was thinking of it in a mainstream neoclassical model, like we were learning at NYU in our PhD program, there's just a bunch of output that shoots out of the out of the pipeline every year, and then you can consume it or you can save it and invest it. And if you invest it, automatically, that just raises the capital stock. And so the capital stock is just a number K indexed by the time period. And so if you save more, if you consume less and save more, that just means K at T plus 1 is bigger than it otherwise would have been, and so total output at T plus 1 is bigger than it otherwise would have been. So it still makes sense to say you overinvested because people still have time preference in those models, and so you could, you know, be starving yourself in the present in order to get extra output in the future that on the margin isn't as useful to you as what you're sacrificing now. But the point is there, you can't even have malinvestment in those models because they're too simple. That there's just, no, how much are you consuming out of output this period, and what you don't consume, you save and invest, and that raises the capital stock for next period that you plug into the production function F. And so F of K and whatever the labor supply is, out pops Y at T plus 1. That's total output. And then at that point, you got to make the decision of total output, how much do we consume, and how much do we save and invest for K T plus 2, or sorry, T plus 2, right? So my point is just these models, but because they throw all the capital stock together and just call it capital, they can't even tell the Austrian story. So of course, when they look out at the world, they don't see the Austrian story coming true because they're not even equipped to see it. It would, you know, it'd be like, I'm trying to come up with analogies here just to get you guys to see this. It would be like if somebody had a theory of the business cycle based on, I don't know, like the magnetic charge or something of capital goods. And, you know, as Austrian economists, that's not even something we think about. We just lump all capital goods together. We don't worry about, do they have a magnetic charge? What the heck are you talking about? We don't even think about that. Or somebody who had a business cycle theory based on what color capital goods were. And, uh-oh, there were too many red machines made last year, and so that's why we had a boom. But now, you know, there's too many blue machines. So if you had a colorblind capital theory, you wouldn't even be able to make sense of that. And so that's what I'm saying is the Keynesians, because they have such aggregation, they don't even get what you're talking about when as an Austrian. Because, or you know, they can read your thing and say they know it, but then when they go and look at the data and switch back into their Keynesian mindset, they can't see it out there because in their mind, no, what the issue here is total spending. And if there's not enough spending, you would see it because of low price inflation and high unemployment. And that's what I see right now. So, duh, the problem is there's not enough spending. Okay, why don't we move on? All right, so the ISLM model, let me just give you a few thoughts on that because I spent a lot of time making sure you guys understood it, and then I didn't tell you do I think it's a good idea or not, or think it's a good framework. So no, the quick answer is I don't think it's a good framework. A couple things that are wrong with it. So this is by no means an exhaustive critique, and for those of you who are taking my classes going through Man, Economy, and State, there we're going to get, it'll actually mostly be in the third section, which hasn't started yet. There we'll get really just line by line going through and just decimating the Keynesian apparatus. But for here, let me just give you a few things. So one problem is the causality that, for example, let's take the IS part. Remember what, let me get the pointer going here. Just remember what these things are saying. The IS curve is the combination, or if you're into math, the locus of points that match up various interest rates, nominal interest rates, with various levels of output. And those are all, to be on the IS curve means investment, total investment equals total saving all along that line. So for those various combinations of I and Y, remember Y is total output. And so the reason it's downward sloping, so this is the tricky part, the reason it's downward sloping is that they're saying the lower the interest rate, typically the higher the more investment spending there is. So that means there needs to be more saving. Right, because I has to equal S. And so it has to be then, if you're talking about a fixed state fraction of income that you're saving, it has to be the total income goes up. So that whatever the percentage is of that, based on the propensity to consume, that you're going to save, that absolute number has to equal the absolute I, right? Because total saving has to equal total investment. Let me say that again, because again, this is something tricky. Keynesians believe total investment equals total saving every period. But they think that income adjusts to make it so. Right? So it's not an idea of, oh, well, somehow people say that's going to somehow find its way into the economy. No, the Keynesians do believe that when you save, in a sense, that's a leakage out of the system. And so that lowers income, and then that lowers investment. Okay, and vice versa. If for some reason we know investment's going to be higher, how is that possible? How do you reconcile the higher investment with saving? Well, income must be higher, because that's the only way to make those two things balance. All right, and that's also why I think maybe you'll see it better when the IS curve shifts out. So to go from that IS1 to IS2, again, to think through what could make it do that. Well, it could be the government running a bigger budget deficit. Well, so why does that make the IS curve shift to the right? Because think of it this way. It's saying, so to say the government is running a bigger deficit is like saying society as a whole is saving a lower fraction of its income. So why would that make the IS curve shift to the right? Because you pick any interest rate, and before you'd stop there, right? For this particular interest rate, you'd go out to the right, boom, and you'd hit that green line right there, drop it down, and so that was consistent with that level of output right there. But now, because this new curve is way out to the right for that same interest rate, you got to keep going to the right, keep going to the right, keep going to the right until you get all the way out there and drop down. All right, so we're saying now, what does it mean to say we drew a new IS curve that's further out to the right? It's saying for any interest rate you pick, total income, total output has to be higher now than before in order to render savings equal to investment. And why is that? Because what we did to make the IS curve shift was people started saving a lower fraction of their income. So just think through that. If saving has to equal investment, because that's an accounting tautology, and now we're saying people are saving a lower fraction of their income, and it's the same interest rate, and the Keynesians think that investment is driven by stuff like, you know, retail sales and their expectations of their future, their animal spirits, and the interest rate, and it's not driven by the availability of savings, well then the fact that people are saving a lower fraction of their income, that's not going to hurt investment. In fact, that's going to boost investment from the Keynesian mindset, right? So we're at the initial equilibrium. All of a sudden, households start saving less. So what do? That means they're going to the store and consuming more. So from the business person's point of view, sales are up. So if anything, they're going to invest more now, because now their sales are up. So they're thinking, oh, times are good. I want to have more capacity. So talking to a Keynesian, all right, if all the households in the economy are saving less and we know investment is up, and households are saving a lower fraction of their income, but yet the total absolute amount of saving has to equal the total absolute amount of investment spending, what has to give? Well, the only thing that can happen is Y has to go up. And so that's why when you model in the Keynesian framework, when you model a reduction in the rate of saving, the IS curve shifts to the right. Or what is the same thing, if the government runs a big budget deficit, that's like saying there's a lower fraction of saving going on. All right, so I'm taking pains to make sure, again, you understand the logic of it. So what would an Austrian, what do I say in response to that? Well, mathematically it's correct. So yeah, it is true that saving equals investment, and it is true that if households are reducing how much they're saving as a fraction of their income, and you're telling me at the same time total investment goes up, then what has to happen to keep all those equations in balance? Well, yeah, it's got to be that income is higher. But from those tautologies, you can't then say in the real world is a causal thing. Ah, therefore, we're initially in an equilibrium, and then households start saving less, therefore total income goes up, if by that you mean real income. That Austrians would think, no, the causality is important. Yes, savings equals investment, but it's not that investment generates the income out of which you save to then fund the investment. No, you have to have previously produced, you have an income that's there, and then you decide, oh, that, how much do I want to save and invest? And that's, so investment is funded out of prior production. You can't invest out of the, you know, thin air. And that's, so you could endorse the Keynesian mathematics and still understand how engineering and physics work and know that people have to go to factories first and produce stuff before you can invest in drill presses. Like, you have to build the thing, you know, you have to have the material first before you can create something. I mean, Paul Krugman presumably wouldn't deny that in order for you to have a drill press, somebody had to first make it, that kind of stuff. Or in order for you to go to the store and spend your money on consumption, buying food and television sets and sports cars, those things had to have been previously produced. It's not that your spending per se draws them into existence. I mean, I think if we pinned him down, he would agree that, yeah, you can't just go to the store with the money and that doesn't actually literally create goods on the shelf. They had to have been previously produced, and we needed resources, scarce resources, to be channeled into that. But nonetheless, the way the Keynesians think about things and their policy prescriptions, they forget that elementary fact. And they talk as if investment creates saving. And I'm not even exaggerating. Let me just take 2 seconds here. Let me see if I have it on my, I don't know if I have it up here on my taskbar. But there was this guy that came across. Somebody sent me this thing. Yeah, investment makes savings possible. Let me just, so this guy is an economist. He's a professional economist. His name's Andy Harless. I don't know if he's a big gun or not. But here, I'll post this in the chat box for those who are curious. Just so you can see, I'm not attacking a straw man here. There are Keynesians who literally believe that, and Keynesians including John Maynard Keynes. I don't know if you guys came across that in the reading of the general theory, but there are parts where Keynes explicitly says that investment spending creates the income out of which the savings is possible in order to render saving equal to investment. All right, so that's nuts. And like I said, this guy's very clever here that I just posted this link to if you want to go read it. And in fact, if you get in head deep into that, you get mixed up and you can't spot the fallacy in what he's doing. It took me 5 or 10 minutes reading this guy's blog post to figure out what he was doing wrong. So it's very seductive, but the point is it's completely backwards in terms of technology or the laws of physics or whatever you want to say, cause and effect. That no, the Austrians say in order to invest, you had to have previously produced, so you could have consumed that output and then you chose not to. You chose to save some of it, and then out of that saving, you can invest. So it's as with many things in Keynesian economics, the Austrians are saying in this particular instance, you don't have to worry about a fallacy of composition. So everybody knows from an individual household's point of view, you can't just say, you know what? I'm going to go invest $50,000 in these corporate stocks, and then that act of investment spending will itself cause my household income to go up by $50,000, so that's how I'll pay for it. Everybody knows that would be insane if an individual household tried to run on Keynesian principles. But the Keynesians say what's true of that individual household breaks down in the aggregate. That in the aggregate, when one household goes out and spends $50,000 investing, that $50,000 is income to somebody else. So it's not income to the original household, but it's income to some other household or group of households. And then that gives them a higher income out of which, you know, their savings will be higher, whatever their fraction of the propensity to save is. And so I'm saying the Austrians are going to deny and say, you know, that could be true in like an accounting sense, but in terms of the real economy, no, there's no problem. You don't need to worry about a fallacy of composition. Just as for an individual household, so too for the whole economy, there's scarcity. And if we're producing more investment goods, then there's fewer consumption goods and vice versa. And then if you want to save and invest, then you have to, or sorry, if you want to invest, you have to first save. It's not that the investment generates the income out of which you save. Okay, as far as the, let me just say a few things about the LM curve. So again, just review. The LM curve is the combination of points such that the demand to hold money equals the quantity of money in existence. So the reason it's upward sloping typically, and, well, I don't want to confuse you guys. So it's typically upward sloping unless you're assuming the central bank is like locking in an interest rate and then it's horizontal. But normally you'd think it would be upward sloping because for a given stock of money, if the interest rate, sorry, if Y goes up, so Y is considered the independent variable for this, if Y goes up, then people have more income. That means they want to spend more. They want to hold higher cash balances, other things equal, but they can't. The community collectively can't hold higher cash balances if there's only a given amount. So something has to also change to make cash less attractive on the margin. And what is that in the Keynesian view? It's the nominal interest rate goes up. So that on the margin you're saying, oh, I'd like to hold more cash because I'm richer now, I have a higher income, and so I buy more stuff, so I want to carry around more money on me. But there's a higher interest rate, and so I could be putting that wealth that I have not in the form of cash, but out earning interest. And so the interest rate has to rise so that on the margin everybody's happy to hold the same quantity of cash as before, even though Y is higher. So that's why this thing is upward sloping. So as far as, you know, the Austrian take on that, there's a couple things that just come to mind. First of all is it's ignoring, you know, nowhere in this, I guess this is also true, the IS curve. There's nothing in here. At no point do you get the fact that the interest rate serves to coordinate investment over time. There's no intertemporal structure of production going on here. And that's kind of tied into the previous point about aggregation. The Austrian idea that there's the price spreads among different orders so that like the wheat that the farmer harvests for a certain amount and then he processes it and sells it to the miller who takes it and then turns it into flour and then who sells it to the baker who takes it and turns it into giant loaves of bread and then sells it to the wholesaler who takes it and then cuts it up and puts it in the little packages and then sells it to the retailer. At each stage there, the finished product sells for a higher amount of money, more total revenue, than the total money spent on all the factors because the people involved, the capitalists involved fronting the money for this operation, they need to earn interest on their investment. Right, so if you're somebody giving money to the farmers to get their wheat, and then you have a bunch of millers processing it and turning it into flour, then you turn around and sell it to the baker. Well, some time elapses in between those two, you know, the expenditure of your money and then the revenue from the bakers when they buy the flour from you. So if you're a capitalist and you're the person in the middle of that, paying out the money to get the wheat and then selling the flour to get the revenue, you need to have some sort of markup. And so in the Austrian framework, that's where the interest rate is key. The interest rate is not, in the typical Austrian view, pinned down in the loan market. No, the interest rate emerges out of the capitalist entrepreneurs in the production markets. You know, buying factors of production, working on them for a little bit, you know, hiring workers to process them, and then selling them to the next guy in the chain all the way down until it finally reaches the final consumer. And so the percentage markup from period to period or stage to stage is where you see the interest rate manifested in the typical Austrian view. And you don't have that at all in this framework. Here, it looks like the only function of the interest rate is to regulate the absolute quantity of investment spending and to temper how much money people want to hold. And so whereas the Austrians say, no, the interest rate does a heck of a lot more than those two things. Another main problem or major problem with this ILM curve is that it's just wrong. I mean, I know it's not a sophisticated critique, but it would be like saying, what happens if the demand to eat apples goes up, and then but there's only so many apples in existence. You know, like right now, tomorrow, the Surgeon General comes out and says eating apples can cure you of cancer or keep you from getting cancer. We didn't realize this, but that's true. And so all of a sudden, everyone wants to eat more apples. But in the short run, we can't just create more apples. It takes time to grow new apples. So what's going to happen is restore equilibrium, because now people want to hold more apples than apples exist. And it would be like the Keynesian saying, the price of oranges must go down. Because then, you know, oranges are a substitute for apples, and so if oranges get really cheap, well, then people won't want to get apples as much. And so, yeah, that's what happens when, if momentarily people want to hold more apples than exist, the way the market fixes that is the price of oranges goes way down, until on the margin they're happy holding, that amount of apples. And if somebody's talking, like, he's like, what are you talking about? That's crazy. What happens is the price of apples goes up if the demand goes up and the supply stays the same. So the same thing with this LM curve. What you're talking about is saying if all of a sudden the demand to hold money goes up while the stock of money stays fixed, what has to give? The Austrian's going to say, well, duh, the price of money goes up, which is the flip side of saying the prices of goods and services quoted in money go down. And that makes perfect sense. If people are trying to hold more cash, that means they're reluctant to spend. So the way you restore equilibrium is prices start falling. And so until their real cash balances are at the desired level. And so, you know, the stuff about the interest rate and whatever, that may be true, but like I said, just like it's true, the price of oranges can affect the demand for apples, but you wouldn't think the way you fix a surplus or a glut in the apple market is to have the price of oranges adjust. And you'd say that's a trivial little thing. It's the same thing here, that the nominal interest rate, would affect the demand to hold cash, but if there's a disequilibrium in the market for cash, the thing that changes ultimately is the price of cash, meaning the purchasing power of money. Okay, got to move on. The multiplier critique. So this is kind of fun. This is from Man, Economy, and State. So, and like I said, this we will specifically cover this in, if you're going with me with the Rothbard class, in the third sequence. Okay, so a standard Keynesian argument, and this was more true like back in the 50s when Rothbard was first writing Man, Economy, and State. So I don't know if you would see this kind of a crude argument like in Paul Krugman's textbook. I don't think you would, but you would have seen it in Samuelson. And so, you know, Rothbard's not inventing a straw man here. This is what Keynesians used to say. All right, so where we get this investment multiplier. So Rothbard is here recapitulating a standard Keynesian argument for the investment multiplier. So you'd say something like, okay, social income equals consumption plus investment. You know, okay, assume there's no government or exports in this simple model. Okay, and then assume the consumption is 0.8 times income. Right, so that's just like the marginal propensity to consume is 0.8, that if you get more income, you consume a fraction of it, not 100%, okay? And then we just start doing algebra with those two assumptions. Okay, so income, we're just rewriting. So this is social income here. We're just rewriting it as regular income here. And then, you know, consumption is down here, but we know that consumption is 0.8 times income, so we've just replaced it, and then we're just bringing this investment down here. Okay, so now we get the new formula, income equals 0.8 times income plus investment. You just rearrange terms. You subtract 0.8 of income from both sides, and so now you get this, 0.2 times income equals investment. And so that means you divide through by 0.2. Oh, look at that. Income equals 5 times investment. And so the multiplier on investment is 5. So the Keynesians would say, if we're, you know, in a recession or whatever, the thing to do is just get some investment going. You know, give tax breaks to businesses if they invest. Krugman has even said stuff like legislation forcing businesses to put in better insulation because of global warming and all that stuff is would actually help the economy by forcing them to invest. He said, you know, and he said normally that wouldn't be true. I grant you, normally we would just be moving along the PPF, and you know that would make us poorer in terms of physical goods, but we'd be richer in terms of the climate because we're fighting global warming. But he said in our current liquidity trap, depressed state with idle resources, if the government actually passed onerous regulations forcing business to go out and spend, you know, just retooling or restructuring their plants, then that would help the economy because there's this investment multiplier. Okay, so if you follow the argument there, Roth versus, okay, watch this. Now, this is in Man, Economy, and State, and that's where I saw it. I presented this at Mises U a couple weeks ago, and somebody came up to me and said, actually, I think Henry Hazlitt invented that argument, and Rothbard thought it was great and just adopted it. So yeah, this may be Hazlitt's actual argument, but I'm drawing on the presentation in Man, Economy, and State. Okay, so Rothbard says, okay, social income equals the income of the person reading my book right now plus the income of everybody else. That's tautology, that's true. And then Rothbard says, notice that right now, this equation is also true. The income of everyone else is 0.99999 times social income. And then, yeah, that's true. We could go statistically look at that if we wanted to. Okay. So then Rothbard just starts doing algebra. Okay, you start rearranging terms, you get 0.00001 times the social income equals the income of just the person reading my book. You divide through by that, and you see social income equals 100,000 times the income of the guy reading my book right now. And so Rothbard concludes, if you were convinced by the Keynesian argument and thought that like government investment expenditures or, you know, tax policies designed to get businesses to invest more, if you thought that had a multiplier of 5, that it would create 5 times as much GDP as the initial expenditure, he said, well, then clearly you got to favor my policy of having the government give just a dollar to the guy reading my book, because that will raise GDP by $100,000, because I've just demonstrated there's a 100,000 multiplier when it comes to the income of the guy reading my book. And so, you know, give the guy $1 million and we're off to the races. Problem solved. And so clearly something's screwy here. And what the catch is, it's this line right here. It's assuming that the fraction of total income that is the social income, you know, or sorry, that is the income of everyone except the reader, assuming that number is going to be the same. That in reality, if you did that policy, if you used the government to take tax money from everyone else and give it to the reader, that would raise the reader's income and lower the income of everybody else, so that this coefficient here would go down a little bit. And so you can't use, I mean, that's what, assuming that coefficient is constant, is what's driving this crazy result, where you're thinking social income equals $100,000 times the income of the reader. So it's true right now, given all these other conditions, yeah, it is true, this equation, that social income equals 100,000 times the income of the reader. Yep. But the fallacy is in assuming that you can start tinkering with those things and the rest will stay the same, so that if you raise the income of the reader by $1, the fallacy is in assuming that the way this equation is going to stay in balance is for social income to go up by 100,000. But no, what could happen is you raise the income of the reader by $1, let's say out of tax revenue, well then the way the equation stays balanced is social income can stay the same, and the 100,000 just goes down a little bit. And then all those other equations are still true. Or in fact, social income could even go down once you take into account the inefficiencies of the tax code and the fact that if you impose taxes on people, they're going to work less and so on. Right? So the point is these tautologies and everything are all still true. The thing that changes is this number right here. Because that's not a tautology. That was just looking at historically what did the income of the reader happen to be in percentage terms compared to total income, and then assuming that was a fixed number, and then we can change one of the other variables, that coefficient won't change, and so we're causing something else to move. So again, it's this issue of the Keynesians aggregating, thinking there are certain fixed relationships between those aggregate numbers, and completely ignoring real-world causality. And just like you know, yeah, it's true, savings equals investment. That's an accounting tautology, depending on how you define the terms. But it does not follow that, therefore, if you increase investment, you must increase saving. That doesn't follow. Okay, so why don't we spend the remaining time here talking about the material for this week. And I did spend longer on that beginning section than I intended, but I think it's okay because, you know, you guys can read these columns and things, and you don't need me to do too much here. So let's just walk through. The one I do want to spend a little bit of time on is Krugman's infamous 2002 column. So let me pull that up. So this is the one called W's Double Dip. Incidentally, for foreign readers, I don't know, or foreign students, in case you're W-D-U-B-Y-A, that's a nickname for George W. Bush, because when he was the governor of Texas, apparently people just called him W, but since they said it with a southern accent, they just called him W. So instead of, you know, because there's lots of Bushes, and so the way they singled him out so you knew you were talking about him and not his father, George Herbert Walker Bush, is you called George W. Bush, you just call him W. And so that's why we call him W, in case you didn't know that. Okay. So Krugman goes through here, and I just want to – actually, I think I have this broken down into PowerPoints. Yeah. So this first slide here, it's spending stupid. I think most of you guys will believe me on this, but, you know, when we talk about Keynesianism in practice and not looking at the elegant models and, well, you know, you could bend over backwards and say they don't really mean it. I mean, clearly, reading this article, Krugman is saying the way you fix an economy is businesses need to invest more and or consumers need to spend more. Right? So it's all about spending. So, again, in fairness to Krugman, he's not just saying consumption spending in this particular article. He is saying some things here about, you know, that business investment spending could do it. But clearly the point is we need more spending, and he's worried that it's not going to come from the usual sources. So he's, say, a ragtag group of ordinary people, America's consumers, is besieged by a rampaging horde, the forces of recession. To everyone's surprise, they've held their ground. Okay, so right off the bat, he's saying so far what's been holding the economy up, as he's writing in 2002, is America's consumers. They've been the people preventing us from falling into recession because, God bless them, they've been spending, spending, spending. And he says, but they can't hold out forever. Will the rescue force, resurgent business investment, get there in time? Okay, so again, I'm just stressing this because there is some confusion. Krugman is not completely a consumptionist. All right, he does think it's about spending, whether it's business or consumer. It's just following the lines of John Maynard Keynes, I would say. He tends to think that it's easier to get consumers to go spend than business because business are just so fickle, where the consumer, you know, they have to eat, they have to go to work, so they need to buy gasoline and, you know, that kind of stuff. It's less discretionary for households to spend than it is for business, I think is the idea. Okay, so Krugman's going on. Consumers kept spending as the internet bubble collapsed, and so in Krugman's mind, that's a good thing. They kept spending despite terrorist attacks, taking advantage of low interest rates. They refinanced their houses and took the proceeds of the shopping mall. Right. So again, somebody writing for LRC or you know, some gold bug website would be writing this in derision, would be like making fun of the typical American shopaholic and, oh my gosh, refinancing your house to go to the mall. and in Krugman's hand, that's the one thing that saved us thus far. That's the one reason the economy's not worse, is because of low interest rates. Consumers took out, you know, refinanced their houses and spent the money at the mall, not even like putting it on a deck or something that might raise the resale value of your house, but no, taking the money, treating your house as an ATM. And Krugman's writing like, but that sort of thing, you know, we can't count on that forever. So what else are we going to count on to get us out of this thing? I mean, it's just, it's naked prose there. It's just, I don't know, shocking. Okay. I'm going to be jumping around a little bit here. So let's see. Next slide. Yeah, pre versus post-war recession. So we get to the part in the article where Krugman says, the basic point is that the recession of 2001 wasn't a typical post-war slump brought on when an inflation-fighting Fed raises interest rates and easily ended by a snapback in housing and consumer spending when the Fed brings rates back down again. On the contrary, this, meaning the dot-com recession, this was a pre-war style recession, a morning after brought on by irrational exuberance. Okay, so let me just make sure you guys know what he's talking about there. In the Keynesian view, there's different types of recessions, and depending on the type of recession, that can affect what policies will work to bring it back. So the Keynesians think that typically after World War II, what would happen is you'd have like a boom period where there was rising aggregate demand, and then the economy would start to overheat, and so the Federal Reserve, to quell price inflation, would raise interest rates and, you know, tighten up on money, and then that would cause the recession. And so unemployment would go up, but the good thing is price inflation would come down. So that's where you had a standard Phillips curve analysis that the Fed had to choose between the two evils. They could have tight money, which would keep a lid on price inflation, but then you might have high unemployment, or you could loosen monetary policy and, you know, have high growth and low unemployment, but the economy eventually starts overheating and you get rising prices, unacceptably high price inflation. So that's what they thought the typical post-war slump was like. So to end the slump was simple. If the reason you were in the slump was because the Fed had jacked up interest rates in order to knock down price inflation, the way you solve that was simple. The Fed just lowers interest rates, and then people start spending more on housing and other stuff, and then you get out, you know, aggregate demand rises, and boom, unemployment falls. So Krugman is saying that's not working this time because we didn't have a dot-com crash due to the Fed getting panicked about price inflation and raising interest rates. No, we had a huge irrational bubble in the NASDAQ that then popped. And then now that's why we have this recession. So his point is lowering interest rates isn't going to, you know, it helps a little bit on the margin, but it's not going to solve this problem because the problem wasn't a previous act of raising interest rates. There was some other thing going on that crippled the economy and is now interfering with people's willingness to spend. And so that's why it's going to take more than the standard remedy of just lowering interest rates. All right. And so that's, he's saying it's like the pre-war recession, because in particular, it's like the Great Depression, that there, you know, there was a huge asset bubble in the late 20s that then burst. And then even though the Fed was cutting interest rates, that wasn't nearly good enough. And that's why you needed fiscal policy, Keynesians would say. And the same thing now, Keynesians argue that what's going on right now with the world economy and the U.S. economy too is that we have this huge debt overhang. And so just low interest rates aren't going to do it, that we built up, you know, people built up way too much debt during the housing bubble years, and now, you know, they have to work that off. And so it's just lowering interest rates isn't going to fix it. Because, again, the problem was not that the Fed raised interest rates to smash the back of price inflation. So the canonical post-war recession for the Keynesians that would be exaggerated would be like the recession in the early 80s, right? So you had price inflation in the late 70s, early 80s. Volcker comes in, says we got to tame inflation, and he jacks interest rates way up, and that crushes the economy. Unemployment's really high. But then once they decide that you know we've caused enough suffering and we've gotten everyone to realize that okay, we've gotten you know chased the inflation expectations out of the system. Okay, we can lower interest rates, and then you resume growth. Incidentally, that's also what the Keynesians now say. When Tom Woods or I or others point to the 1920 and 21 depression, if you guys are familiar with that, in that depression, which was following World War I, the government and the Fed did what should have been the exact opposite of good policy from a Keynesian or a monetarist perspective. They raised interest rates to record highs, and they slashed spending considerably. Like in 1 year, they cut the budget by like 66% or something. Right? So I don't mean they cut the rate of growth. I'm saying they cut the absolute amount that the federal government spent by over 60% in 1 year, because this was right when World War I ended, and so you know they were shrinking the government because the war was over. And price inflation had been really high, so they jacked interest rates up. So they did that. And, of course, we had the roaring 20s after that. And so my point, Tom Wood's point, and others who have picked up on this, is to say, wait a minute, you Keynesians. If you're saying the reason we had the Great Depression in the 1930s is that the Fed didn't inflate enough, that, yeah, it pushed down interest rates, but we were on the gold standard, and so you know they couldn't push interest rates low enough. And Herbert Hoover, yeah, he ran big deficits, but not big enough. It wasn't until World War II that we really – ran big enough deficits. And so you said, wait a minute, you guys are crazy. The government and the Fed did the sorts of things you guys recommend, perhaps half-heartedly, in the 30s, and we had a decade depression. The government and the Fed did the exact opposite of what you guys say, namely they jacked up interest rates and they slashed spending in 1920 and 21, and that depression, as its name suggests, was only 18 months. And then we had a very strong recovery after. So you guys are crazy. So I'm just telling you, the way the Keynesians deal with that is they say, oh, no, those are entirely different animals. They're saying the 1920-21 depression, that wasn't caused by some financial panic. That wasn't caused because banks had awful balance sheets or that consumers had taken on way too much debt. No, the Fed caused the 1920 and 21 depression, and with the government too, because the government slashed spending and the Fed jacked up interest rates. So they caused the, you know, they intentionally brought on a recession in order to break the back of price inflation. And then once they thought they had done that, they let interest rates back down to normal levels and you got strong recovery. Whereas in the early 30s, the Keynesians would say that was completely different. It was, you know, disaster in the private sector, in the financial markets, that caused the recession, and at that point, policymakers were pushing on a string. They couldn't stimulate by lowering interest rates, whereas all it took was lowering interest rates in 1921 or 22, whenever they did it, in order to go from slump back to recovery. All right, so I don't think that's a good response, but I'm just explaining to you guys so you understand, if you're arguing with a Keynesian, that's what the sophisticated Keynesian will say to you. And that's what Krugman's talking about here when he says it's the difference between a pre- and post-war recession. Okay, and now we get to the best thing. So Krugman says, to fight this recession, the Fed needs more than a snapback. It needs soaring household spending to offset more abundant business investment. And to do that, as Paul McCauley of PIMCO put it, Alan Greenspan needs to create a housing bubble to replace the NASDAQ bubble. So there you have it in all its glory. And, you know, just if we just had this column to go off of, as Danny Sanchez points out, that's all we need. I mean, that's a smoking gun right there. End of story. The only way you can get around Krugman denying that he was advocating a housing bubble was for him to say he didn't think the Fed should try to end the recession. and that when he's talking about watching this movie, he wants the good guys to get slaughtered at the end of the movie. I mean, because he set the analogy up such that if spending rises, the good guys in the movie win. I mean, that's the analogy he's been drawing all through the article up until this point. And now he's saying, in terms of his neutral economic analysis, the only way spending is going to rise above this is if Alan Greenspan creates a housing bubble to replace the NASDAQ bubble. So, yeah, it's true. Krugman might prefer that no bubble was necessary. That's fine. I mean, just like saying, well, you know, suppose Jim Kirk on the Enterprise showed up and gave everybody machines that could create food and stuff out of thin air. Is Krugman against that? Well, no, he probably would be for that. But the point is, Krugman was saying the only options he saw were for the Fed to create a housing bubble to replace the NASDAQ bubble or continued recession. And how can anybody reading this think that Krugman was saying, I want Alan Greenspan to do nothing. I want Alan Greenspan to sit back and let people stay unemployed because heaven forbid we get a housing bubble. He's clearly not saying that. You have to be crazy to think that Krugman is not recommending a housing bubble here. But why I'm saying he was, what did I forget the title of my site? Krugman couldn't have been worse is it's actually true. There is a sense in which you could say Krugman wasn't recommending a housing bubble. It's because he didn't think Greenspan could do it. So it's actually even worse. It would be one thing if Krugman said in 2002, you know what, Greenspan has the power, and I think he should do it. I think he should just go ahead and create a housing bubble because that's the only thing that's going to get us out of this. That would be bad enough. What Krugman said was the only way we could get out of this is if Greenspan could create a housing bubble, but I don't think he can. So he was wrong on both counts, both on his advocacy and his opinion if it were possible. So, I mean, you could not be a worse economist in a given article than what Krugman was here. All right, why don't we move on? So Krugman's slick defense, and I've already covered some of this stuff, analysis, not advocacy. Danny Sanchez alludes to some of it. I'm not sure. Yeah, he linked to Krugman. I mean, Krugman's thing, like, yeah, I was on the grassy knoll, too. For foreign viewers, in case you don't know what Krugman's talking about there, let me just type it out in case you don't even understand my pronunciation. So grassy knoll. That what he's referring to are the conspiracy theories surrounding the death of John F. Kennedy. So John F. Kennedy, you know, was in the motorcade going around, and the official story says that Oswald was in the book depository and shot him from certain angles. But a lot of the people who were in the I don't know if you can call it parade, the pedestrians, the bystanders, the crowd that was there as President Kennedy's driving by, they told investigators later that they thought they heard shots coming from what they called the grassy knoll, which is like a hill that was in the other direction. And so the people who think that more than one person was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy frequently refer to the fact that there were shots heard from the grassy knoll. So that's what. So when Krugman says, yeah, I was at the grassy knoll too, he's being sarcastic to say, oh my gosh, you guys are saying I caused the housing bubble? Okay, yeah, and I killed JFK too. So that's what he's trying to do there, is to make it look like the very idea that I would have recommended a housing bubble, you guys are nuts. Okay, so, and what he says, as Danny links to and explains, is that, and just to make sure you guys know, so the guy, the Daniel Sanchez that wrote two of the articles for this week is the guy who runs Mises Academy, so make sure you guys know that. So he just goes through it masterfully, you know, I'm just repeating his arguments here, but just points out that doesn't fly, Krugman. Because what Krugman was trying to say is, no, I wasn't recommending a housing bubble. I was just saying that was the corner into which we were painted. But as Danny points out, and I just mentioned a minute ago, no, that's not true, Krugman. The only way out of that is, you know, the point is, given that you thought we were painted into that corner and that Greenspan had to choose between do we create a housing bubble or do we let the recession fester, what did you want to do? And you wanted him to create a housing bubble. It's true. You were a bad economist, and you predicted he wouldn't be able to do it, but he did do it. And in the narrative you were telling with your article there, the good guys won. The cavalry arrived. The consumers were on the ropes. Them going to the mall, refinancing their house was holding out, but they were running out of, you know, all hope was left. And then, phew, Greenspan created a housing bubble, and that got everyone spending enough. I mean, that is the narrative he was telling, and that is what happened. And so we can lay at his Keynesian analysis blame for the resulting bubble and then the mess we were in 2008. Another thing here is Krugman, I touched on this in the beginning of the lecture, he is not a hangover theorist, meaning he does not think that recessions are the punishment for previous bouts of overspending. Right? He says that repeatedly. He says things like, he can, you know, macro policy is not a morality tale. These right wingers, these Ron Paul types, they're mixing their you know, Protestantism with their economic analysis. They want to punish Americans for their sins during the housing bubble, and that's why they're recommending austerity right now when that's not needed. Right? So Krugman is huge. I didn't give you a bunch of material this week, but trust me, he is. He says it very frequently that it is simply not true that we need to suffer a bad economy just because we had a previous era of you know, irrational exuberance. So you might say, wait a minute, Bob, but didn't he just say in the column you just read that the 2001-2002 recession was due to irrational exuberance? Yes, it would have been in a free market economy. So that's the distinction I'm drawing here. Krugman is saying, yeah, you can build up debt and so forth and have people get over leveraged and then have a hangover if the Fed sat back and did nothing, and or the government sat back and did nothing. But thank goodness we don't have people who are a bunch of Puritans running policy, or at least we need not have that. You can have guys like me telling you what to do. We don't need to sit around with unemployed idle resources because of the mistakes of the past. We just need to get total spending up, and that will employ everybody, and that will help us grow out of the mistakes that we made during the previous excesses. All right, so for Krugman, so in other words, what I'm trying to say is Krugman's slick defense, he's trying to make it look like now they say, no, what I meant in 2002 was that we were basically hopeless, that there was nothing anybody could do except, well, yeah, I guess you could create a housing bubble, but that's just going to set us up for a bigger problem, and that I was just a genie. You know, Krugman was like the bearer of bad news, and now we're blaming the prophet for telling us in 2002 what lay in store. And I'm saying he most certainly did not. You know, again, the analogies with the heroes, he wasn't saying, can the besieged heroes fight off the marauders and then walk outside the Alamo and realize there's a moat with crocodiles in it and they fall in and get eaten to death. You know, that would have to be, the, you know, that's not the way it went down. No, Krugman was saying if you could get spending up, you would solve the problem, and he was just biting his nails over, is Greenspan going to be able to get people to spend more? And like I say, he's got all kinds of stuff now saying he is not a hangover theorist, that it's not true that you need to suffer because of the mistakes of the past. So he can't claim now that in 2002 what he meant was there were no good options and that, yeah, I guess you could have a housing bubble, but we're going to then have trouble down the road. No, he thought there was a way to thread the needle, that you could have a housing bubble, get spending up, but then, you know, take the foot off the gas and take the gasoline out of the fire, or whatever metaphor you want to take away the punch bowl, whatever metaphor you want to use, before the bubble got out of hand. And so, and then that leads us to the smoking gun. So this is from 2006, which was the assigned reading. So this, I think, like I said, you don't need this, the 2002 article with all those movie analogies, and how could anybody deny that Krugman was saying Greenspan should have done that? But here, in 2006, I mean, he explicitly says it. So a reader had asked him, did Greenspan do the right thing given the constraints he faced? And Krugman said, as Paul McCauley of PIMCO remarked when the tech boom crashed, Greenspan needed to create a housing bubble to replace the tech bubble. So within limits, he may have done the right thing. All right, so it's Krugman. He has to put the word may in there. I mean, Krugman never flat out says, you know, I think Krugman would say 2 + 2 quite possibly equals 4. But, I mean, for Krugman, that's pretty much a direct admission. And then he says, you know, he tries to get himself out. Oh, but by late 2004, he should have seen the danger signs and warned against what was happening. All right, so he didn't even say he should have raised interest rates. He just should have said something. Okay, so, I mean, just, anyway, I'm getting worked up. Another point, and Danny had brought this up, too, in his articles, one of the defenses Krugman made and his apologists made, you know, after the fact when this stuff started circulating, in case you guys don't know, this was huge for a while. Like when Mark Thornton made that blog post about Krugman did cause the housing bubble, the reason he was doing that is because this got to be hot stuff. When that 2002 article started making the rounds, you know, various right-wing type people were laughing. And, oh, Krugman, look at you. You called for the housing bubble. Yeah, that's a good job. And so his fans had to go on the defensive and defend the honor of their guru. And so one of the things they said is, you know, oh, my gosh, you right-wing hatchet job men, you're taking Krugman out of context. Krugman wasn't saying that Greenspan should do that. He was just quoting Paul McCauley of PIMCO. All right? And clearly, you go read it in the 2002 article, Krugman is endorsing the analysis. And here, he's literally endorsing. He's saying, as Paul McCauley said, you know, it's not like saying, you know, as Chairman Mao said, politics comes from the barrel of a gun. I mean, no, Krugman is saying something with which he agrees here. And how could you deny that? Okay. So, why don't we move on? One last slide here, and I'll turn over to your questions. There's this issue of monetary versus fiscal stimulus. This is a basic thing, but I want to make sure, I don't know if I've ever said this in this class before, and so you guys should be aware of this. So in terms of the terminology, so monetary policy is the Federal Reserve, things like open market operations, setting interest rates, that sort of thing, controlling the quantity of the monetary base. And so that's what Ben Bernanke is in charge of. Fiscal policy means government budget deficits or government spending and taxing, whether it's a surplus or a deficit. And so the Treasury Secretary right now in the United States is Timothy Geithner. So what Krugman's general view is that you don't need fiscal deficits, or I'm being redundant, you don't need budget deficits to stimulate the economy so long as you're not in a liquidity trap. All right, so you don't need to, let me put it this way. I could not find evidence of Krugman ever recommending big budget deficits as a means of stimulating economic growth or reducing unemployment when interest rates were already, you know, like high or medium range. So as long as the Fed had room to cut interest rates, I am prepared to believe Krugman when he says that's all he would ever recommend. All right, so Krugman has explicitly said on his blog in response to critics that, hey, guys, I am not somebody who preaches the virtues of deficits all the time. The only time as a Keynesian I am in favor of deficit spending as a means to stimulate the economy is when conventional monetary policy has failed, and I don't think the Fed has the cojones to do unconventional policy. So in that sort of environment where you've got Ron Paul breathing down Bernanke's neck and Bernanke is afraid to do the right thing, then yes, it's up to the Treasury to run a big budget deficit. But Krugman says, I would never recommend that if we weren't in a liquidity trap. That if interest rates are 4% before you would ever have the government run a budget deficit, no, first you have the Fed lower interest rates to 3% and to 2% and to 1%, and it's only once you hit the 0% lower bound and the economy is still in a slump, then you start thinking about having the government run budget deficits. Okay, so that clearly is what Krugman has said his view is. I didn't believe him. I thought, oh, give me a break, Krugman. You know, you've never seen government spending you didn't like. I can't believe that you would ever say the government should cut spending and have that be offset by the Fed lowering interest rates. Can you imagine, like, if unemployment were 8%, or let's say 6% in a typical kind of recession, and the government had like a $300 billion deficit, but interest rates were at 4%. Can you possibly imagine Paul Krugman recommending that the government cut spending, especially like if it's on food stamps or something, but then have the Fed lower interest rates to offset that so the aggregate demand doesn't go down? It's inconceivable. Krugman would never say that. So I tried to go find examples of that, you know, to prove him a liar, and I couldn't. All right, so I'm just admitting that. Now, I think there are some reasons for that, because if you think about it, right now, why is Krugman so big on deficit spending, and why is his why is it convenient for him ideologically that his analysis seems to line up with praising big government deficits? Because right now, there's a Democrat in the White House who's running big deficits, and right-wing conservative types are demanding austerity. So Krugman, you know, ideologically, it lines up everything if his supposedly neutral economic analysis says that budget deficits are fine right now. When he was, you know, so what he says to try to prove that, no, I'm not always for deficits. I was against deficits just a few years ago. Well, that's because there was a Republican in office who had given big tax breaks to rich people. I mean, he had just lowered marginal rates, but it is true that rich people did get tax breaks under George W. Bush. So ideologically, and he, you know, invaded Iraq, which cost a lot of money. So ideologically, if Paul Krugman thinks George Bush is the devil and George Bush is running huge deficits, it made sense for Krugman's economic analysis to say at that point, no, deficits are bad and irresponsible. And another thing is, so this issue of monetary versus fiscal stimulus, Krugman actually did have a column where, you know, he sort of made me back off and think, okay, maybe he's telling the truth. When Dick Cheney was out on the campaign, well, I don't know if it's a campaign trail, but Dick Cheney, the vice president of George W. Bush, was out touting their, they had given, was it, I might be getting a little mixed up as to what the specific thing was, but the general story is right, but I might be botching the details, but I think it was in the 02, you know, like in 2002, roughly, to try to stimulate the economy, you know, Bush and everybody were talking about tax cuts, and so Cheney was saying how that's going to stimulate spending. And so Krugman just tore him a new one, saying that was crude Keynesianism, and that we all, you know, modern Keynesians know that you don't need the Treasury to stimulate aggregate demand so long as you're not in a liquidity trap and so long as there's room for the Fed to cut interest rates. So it is, you know, to his credit, or whatever you want to call it, it is true that Krugman is on record in a certain situation saying, no, I don't favor having a bigger budget deficit. I favor lower interest rates. But again, he was doing it to make fun of Dick Cheney. So I can't quite give him a gold star for neutrality and even-handed analysis, because I think he got lucky. You know, and then you say, okay, well, what about under Bill Clinton? Well, yeah, Krugman was okay with budget surpluses then. He wasn't whining about the evils of austerity, because Clinton had a boom and he had surpluses, and Clinton was a liberal Democrat. All right, so, I was thinking, okay, the one thing would be, I need to find what did Paul Krugman say when George H.W. Bush was in office and had big deficits and had a recession on his hands. Did Krugman say that George H.W. Bush should have cut government spending but had Greenspan lower interest rates? I'd be curious to see Krugman calling for lower government spending with high unemployment, but I don't think he wrote columns back then. Okay, so you see what I'm saying? That I went through trying to find a situation where Krugman's ideology would go one way, but his professed neutral Keynesian analysis would go another, and I think he just got lucky that situation never arose. That when there were budget deficits that fit with his thing about when you should have them, that's when Obama was in office. When there were budget deficits where the Fed did have room to cut, that's when George W. Bush was in office. And then when Clinton was in there, you had a surplus with a booming economy. So anyway, my point is, I hope you guys didn't get lost there. I'm just trying to, so the big picture is, Krugman nowadays officially says, I am not someone who is always in favor of budget deficits. The only time I'm in favor of a budget deficit as a means to stimulate economic growth is when the Fed has run out of conventional options and has pushed interest rates down to zero and we're in a liquidity trap. And he said, if that's not the case, if interest rates are like 2, 3, 4%, you will never see me calling for a budget deficit. I will always first say the Fed should cut interest rates. And so, like I said, I thought he was lying, but I couldn't actually find him doing the opposite. But I think it's partly because that never came up. There was never a time when his politics would have wanted him to say the opposite. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, Aaron Sperling in the comments here says, I wonder if Krugman will change his mind if a Republican wins the next election. Yeah, that would be interesting. What he would do for sure, and this is what's her name, Rachel Maddow did, if some Republican wins and then has a huge budget deficit and then says we're not going to raise taxes because that will, that will kick the economy when it's down, Krugman will oppose that because he'll say that set us up for a long-term thing. Even down the road when we don't need when we don't need budget deficits, your tax cuts for rich people right now will still be programmed in there, and that will constrain us in the future. Just like right now, they're still blaming the Bush tax cuts for the revenue shortfall we have right now. So for sure, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that Krugman will say, no, it's deficits are fine, but it's better to have, you can go ahead and raise taxes on rich people, but just have the government spend enough to offset that so that the impact on aggregate demand, because it's easier, he would say, to eliminate temporary spending than it is to get rid of the tax cut, which actually I think is wrong politically anyway, but that's I'm virtually certain that's what he would say. So, yeah, he would not recommend that a Republican get rid of the deficit immediately, but I think he would say what you need to do is have a deficit through social spending and spending on, green jobs or whatever pet project Krugman thinks is cool, and go ahead and raise taxes because, the incentive effects on rich people end up because, rich people save a lot anyway, so you're not actually going to reduce total spending all that much by raising the top marginal rates. I think he would say something like that. Okay, we got about 10 minutes left. Let me turn it over to your questions. I probably got kicked out of the system, so it might take a second for me to log in. Okay, it says website currently unavailable. That's awkward. If any of you are logged in right now to the Ask the Questions of the Professor Week 7, can you post the thing in the chat box? Because I'm not able to get in for some reason. Or any of you who posted questions, if you remember what you asked me, can you go ahead and repeat them in the chat box here? So sorry about that. This must be some technical issue with Moodle right now. So, how's everyone's 401k? Okay, got a question. Good. Okay, Jorge says, Bob, when Keynesian monetarists include micro foundations, why do they not include sound money as a key element? Microeconomics ignores money, but for individual actors, entrepreneurs, workers, etc., sound money is crucial for the present and future plans. Yeah, well, okay, it's a really good question. So let's just make sure we know what he's talking about. Remember, in I think it was week 5, we went over the evolution of Keynesian thought from the the prose and general theory through the what was called hydraulic Keynesianism, just the graphs that you're familiar with, ISLM and things like that, in at the hands of Hicks and Samuelson. And then in response to the critiques of people like Milton Friedman and most particularly Robert Lucas, who leveled the rational expectations objection, there was a revolution in economics, and now everybody likes to have what's called rational expectations in their models. And so again, this is mostly review here, that doesn't mean that the agents in the models are omniscient or that, you know the world with certainty. There still are things that are random in those models, and so you can make a mistake, but only in the sense that a blackjack player, if you're dealt an 11 and a dealer showing a 6, the right move is to double down, even though that might end up costing you twice as much money. You know. In other words, if you actually knew the cards that, if you knew the dealer's down card and you knew the cards on the top of the deck, you might realize the best move is for you to hit 3 times or whatever. But the proper move statistically, given the information you had at the time, would be to double down. So that's the sense in which that's the I don't know how to describe it. It would be very hard to get a mainstream paper published if your model didn't obey rational expectations, if you had people making mistakes. And if you're wondering, like, what do you mean? So the old school Keynesian models had people make mistakes? Well, yeah, because in the old school Keynesian models, you know, you might have like a wage rigidity, and then, you know, the workers wouldn't take a pay cut because they didn't want to see their wages go down. But then if the Fed causes inflation, they work more. The workers work more because they think they're getting paid more. And so stuff like that, where not realizing that they're getting paid less, you know, falling for money illusion, things like that. So in modern models, you can't have people being stupid like that. That the people in the model have to understand how the model works. And so, yeah, there can be uncertainty, but they have to know the bounds of the uncertainty or the parameters of it. They have to know like what the distribution and what the mean and the variances and things like that, if there's a variable in the model, right? So one way of describing it, and they also, what they did is called, they gave the models micro foundations. And so before, they would just do things like, say, you know, they look statistically in the aggregate over the data from 1946 to 1956, and they'd say, oh, the last 10 years in the United States, consumption spending tended to be, I'm making this up, 81% of total output, and so we're just going to model that in here in this econometric thing, and there we get a multiplier of 4.8, and so if the government boosts in spending, investment spending, then we get this amount in GDP and blah, blah, blah. So there were no agents in the model. There was no optimization going on. It was just they were looking at macro relationships and then deriving policy conclusions. So in addition to saying we want rational expectations, they were saying there needs to be somebody to be rational in the model. So we have to have somebody representing the consumers. We have to have the central bank with like policy rules. We have to have businesses that are maximizing profits, given a production function and prices and things like that, and the demand they see for their product. So the point is they start populating the models with decision makers, and then so it gets trickier now to make the model have all this stuff come out right. Because, you know, first pass, the types of models that people in Chicago, University of Chicago, were cranking out, you couldn't have a business cycle. Because they had consumers and business people, and they were hyper-rational, and they knew everything. You know, and the government would come out and run a big budget deficit, and so all the people in the model knew, oh, our taxes are going up because now the government's got a bigger debt, so we have to save more because we need to put aside more money to pay for the higher tax bill. So if the government gave, you know, let's say the government gave $100 billion tax cut to try to stimulate aggregate demand, that would do absolutely nothing, because the private sector would save $100 billion more. And so the government would just be borrowing what the private sector was saving, and total spending would be the same. All right, and also you couldn't if there was a shock to productivity, that workers all of a sudden were 3% less productive, well, then wages would instantly go down 3%. And so nothing would get messed up. You couldn't have a business cycle. So the point was, it was kind of tricky to make models that showed Keynesian-type outcomes where there was a recession unless the government came in and spent more or unless the Fed cut interest rates, and yet where the agents in the model understood what was going on and were rational. All right, so that's what was called giving micro foundations to these Keynesian macro models. So now the question is, why don't they have sound money in there? And you actually, I feel bad that I took so long explaining that question, because you answered it yourself, or that in mainstream models, you don't need money. Money is just a numeraire. They have to have money because they want the Fed to do something, because the whole point of the model is to tell the Fed what to do in the real world. So there has to be money in there. But there's no reason that agents need money in the model, because the agent knows everything. He, you know, has the vector of prices of all the consumption goods if you have that, or there might just be one consumption good. So if there's just one good and there's a certain amount of output and there's one agent that lives forever, and I'm not attacking a straw man. I mean, this is the workhorse model that I spent a year learning at NYU and when I got my PhD there. That there's a, you know, production function F, and the two inputs are capital K for capital and capital L for labor, and then out pops Y, and you decide how much do you want to consume and how much do you want to save for next period. And that's the whole economy right there. And there's one agent with one utility function. And, you know, he discounts the future, and so his utility is a function of how much he consumes this period and then discounting the flow of consumption over time. So in that sort of world, you don't need money because there's no one to trade with. So they come up with, you know, they have prices and stuff just because, but you don't really need that stuff. So and as far as, like, why is inflation bad? It's actually hard in that kind of model to show why price inflation is bad. Because if you anticipate everything, you know, whether you have perfect price stability or prices rising by 72% a year, as long as you knew it beforehand with certainty, it wouldn't matter. And so it's, I think that's part of the difficulty with these models, is that there's really no reason to hold money in them, and then yet you're deriving conclusions about monetary policy from analyzing these models. So the whole thing is just nuts. Okay, I probably got time for one more question. So, Jorge, don't misunderstand. I'm agreeing with you, but I'm answering your question. You're saying, how come they don't have sound money in there? And I'm explaining why. Because there'd be no point. They would say, if anything, it would be market failure to have gold or some other commodity money, because there could be a problem that the market would under or over provide it. And why would you take that chance? You could just have fiat money issued by a central bank, and then whatever the optimal thing is to do, the central bank could do it. Whereas if you trust the market to mine a commodity, it might screw it up. And that was their mentality. I literally had a guy in my program say to me one time when I was talking about the socialist calculation debate, he literally said to me, well, like, just matter-of-factly, like, he was puzzled that this is even an issue, saying, well, of course the central planning solution is Pareto superior to the decentralized market outcome. He said, because whatever the market would do, the central planner could just mimic, but then the central planner has more options, right? So the central, you know, whatever the market would do, the central planner could do also. So the central planner has to be at least able to match the market's performance. But then, in case the market's doing something bad or suboptimal, the central planner can avoid that mistake. And so in this guy's mind, duh. I mean, it'd be like saying, you know, if you're playing chess, do you want your queen to be able to move in every direction or just to be able to move forward? And obviously, you'd want your queen to be able to move in every direction. That can't hurt you to have more options. And so in his mind, how can it possibly hurt to have a socialist central planner? Because he can just, if he wants to, he can do nothing and let the market take its course, or he can improve upon it. I mean, that was the mentality when you're dealing, and it's, you know, that's crazy to us from an Austrian perspective, but if you've grown up and never read Henry Hazlitt, never read what we consider free market economics, never read Bastiat or Say or, you know, Murray Rothbard, and all you've done is study mathematical models, well, why wouldn't you think like that? Okay, maybe one more question. Somebody says, Bob, will the proposed debate with Krugman ever happen, and what needs to be done to progress it? It still could happen. I think what would have to happen, though, is, well, one of two things. One would be if we just got a ton of donations pledged. If people don't know what I'm talking about, go to KrugmanDebate.com. Mention that in case some people don't know what we're talking about. So KrugmanDebate.com will answer all your questions. Right now, there's like $70,000 pledged. It's sort of tapered off at that. So one thing that could happen is let's say it broke 100,000 or 200,000, and I got like the right-wing newspapers in New York to start running articles about it, and I got the food bank to issue a press release saying, you know, we could really use that money, Dr. Krugman, so why don't you consider please debating this guy, blah, blah, blah. That could happen, and I do have some videos and things and, you know, funny stuff to do to publicize the guy. I've been too busy to do it. The other thing would be if some promoter approached Krugman and said, hey, I think I could sell a lot of tickets if you debated this guy. So, you know, if you'll agree to do it, I'll give you half of the gate or whatever. And so Krugman knew that he was going to get a big check. Because the way my thing is set up, Krugman and I don't get any money. It's just whatever gets pledged goes to the food bank. So there's really no reason for him personally to do it except, you know, his vanity. So that's the other way I could see it possibly happening. So I haven't given up on it. It's just I've been real busy with other stuff, and I can't do something fun like have someone tape a video or make a video about my debate with Paul Krugman, even though I have some funny ideas. Okay. Well, I got to stop here, guys, so thanks for tuning in. I'll have your quizzes posted by Friday. And then we've got just one more week left. And for those of you taking the class, then it'll be time for your exam. So I'll keep you posted with everything. Okay, so long, everybody. Oh, and also, if you're interested, this Friday, Danny, can you post the link to that thing about the WebEx conference? This Friday, I'm having a web seminar, I don't know if seminar is the word, conference, for 90 minutes, just summarizing the state of the U.S. economy. You know, I'm not giving specific financial advice because that's kind of risky to do, but for people who are wondering what the heck is going on with the markets, I'll try to summarize the way the things are, the way I see things from an Austrian perspective. So that this Friday, and Danny just posted the thing. So if you're listening to this and you can't see the link, it's just go to academy.mises.org. And you'll see the option there to sign up for that if you're interested. So that is going to be on Friday, August 12th at I think 6 p.m. Eastern time. If you're interested in doing that, it's just a 90-minute deal, and it costs $25. Okay. Thanks, everybody. I'll see you either Friday or in the office hours.